From NPR and WBUR, I'm Don Gagne.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. We're getting reaction to the Department of Justice watchdog report that lays out serious problems with the investigation against former USA Gymnastics doctor Larry Nassar. The DOJ Inspector General says FBI agents failed to respond with urgency to complaints that Nassar had sexually abused more than 150 athletes over the course of years. And it said that senior FBI officials in the Indianapolis field office lied to the Inspector General about its investigation. Nassar is serving a 175-year prison sentence, but now some U.S. senators are calling for potential criminal charges for incompetence at the FBI. Joining us now is Rachel Den Hollander. She's a former gymnast and one of Nassar's victims. Rachel, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thanks so much for having me on.
And looking back at your own experience with law enforcement in this case against Larry Nassar, does this report surprise you at all?
You know, I wish I could say that it does, but it really doesn't. The reason I chose to come forward so publicly as the whistleblower was because I was confident that there, in fact, had likely been botched investigations and likely outright corruption with law enforcement. And so as much as I wish I could say this is a surprise, it's not. This is what survivors face all the time. We just finally got a spotlight on this case.
Yeah, tell me, if you could, your own experience. Did you get the sense when you were speaking with investigators that they were taking you seriously?
So I was incredibly blessed to have a phenomenal investigator in MSU PD, Andrea Munford, and then also a phenomenal prosecutor in Angie Povilaitis. But I, you know, out of every survivor that I work with, Nassar survivors and otherwise, it's incredibly rare to be able to say that. And I think that's something we have to grapple with culturally, is that this report, what it unveils here is not an anomaly. It really is the norm. Out of every 230 rapes reported to the police, only about 6 result in criminal charges, only about 5 result in conviction and jail time. And our conviction rates for non-rape sexual assaults are even worse. And what we see in this FBI report is just some of why we have those dynamics and why survivors don't feel safe to speak up.
One of the things that the report said was that Larry Nassar continued working with young women and girls for a year after authorities were aware of the allegations against him, and that more than 70 athletes in that time were abused. How does that news hit you?
It's horrifying. It's evil. It's disgusting. And it actually downplays the reality of what took place. It was actually closer to 18 months before I came forward publicly. What we need to be asking now is what we're not seeing.
Why do you think there was such an apparent lack of urgency at the FBI?
Yeah, again, this is not unique. This is a story every survivor faces. We have a situation in this country where law enforcement is often very poorly trained to even understand evidence and trauma. What we have to realize is that it took 6 years and hundreds of victims and intense public pressure to be able to shine a light on the failure of law enforcement. Every single FBI officer who did not bother to launch a proper investigation, who did not accurately report, who colluded with USAG, all of those bad actors have moved on. And there are no consequences while the survivors are left to pick up the pieces. If we have seen this much in one case, in one report, after 6 years of pushing for answers, what's happening everywhere else that we're not seeing? To survivors that don't have that kind of help and support.
And you're referring there to the special agent in charge of the Indianapolis field office. His name is Jay Abbott. The inspector general's report said that he made false statements to investigators and that he was seeking a job with the U.S. Olympic Committee during all of this. So what does accountability at the FBI for these mistakes look like for you? What do you want?
It looks like punitive action. It looks like a recognition of the incredible failure in the system that goes above and beyond the statement that's been released that essentially says bad things happen. We don't want this to happen. This report lays bare the failures and then essentially says, but those failures don't matter enough to have those hard conversations to put real consequences in place.
Rachel, you mentioned those little girls, the victims. Of course, you were a victim as well. And I wonder if the acknowledgement that there were serious errors in this investigation will help you and those other girls somehow heal, or does it just open up the wound even further?
I am grateful for the recognition that we did get I'm grateful for the DOJ's investigation. If we're going to change what's happening in our culture of rape and abuse that goes straight to the top of law enforcement, we have to start having serious discussions about how we have accountability and consequences for bad actors in law enforcement, because they have all the power and authority and none of the accountability.
Rachel Den Hollander is a former gymnast and a whistleblower that helped bring the sexual abuse by Larry Nassar to light. Rachel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Some extra money is on the way for parents with young children. Starting today, parents who qualify will receive monthly payments of up to $300 per child. That's because of a child care tax credit that was expanded during the pandemic. President Biden says it will lead to a historic cut in the child poverty rate. Joining us is Dr. Lucy Marcel, a pediatrician at the Boston Medical Center who co-founded the Street Cred Tax Help Program. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
You work with people in need every day. What are you hearing from them about what difference these payments are going to make in their lives?
So these tax credits will be transformational to families. For example, one of the families I spoke to recently, the mom has a child who's about 1 year old. She's been wanting to go back to work, but can't actually afford to work because she can't afford childcare. So after I educated her about the new child tax credit, that it's a regular payment she can count on, and that it is not taxable, the relief in the room was just palpable. And she immediately said, okay, I can go back to work now. I can use this money to pay for childcare.
So people will get a check, but it is a tax credit. That's an important distinction. Who qualifies?
Yeah, it's a great point. So 93% of American children qualify. The only children who don't are high-income children and children who are not citizens, who don't have a Social Security number. And this is really important because previously the child tax credit mostly benefited a different group, middle and higher income children. So many parents are not aware of this credit and don't realize that they do qualify.
Do people have to do any special paperwork to get into the program and to start getting the money?
So in theory, no. Most families, the projection is somewhere between 80 and 85% will automatically get these payments. And they will do that because they have filed taxes and claimed their children in the past. So the government, the IRS, who is distributing the money, will be aware of them. And then for families who haven't filed taxes but claimed stimulus payments last year, they are also already in the system and will get the money. But there are several groups who are expected to miss out. That 15 to 20% of children are, unfortunately, some of the most vulnerable. These kids live in families who are often in deep poverty, so they really did not have a reason to file taxes. There also are families who are mixed status, meaning the parent is not a citizen and may not be documented, but the child is a citizen. Those children are also owed this tax credit, but to get it, the parents have to get a special sort of filing number called an I-10, file a tax return, claim the child, and then they will get the money. Understandably, many of these parents are worried about the safety of doing so. And then a final group of children who are going to at least temporarily miss out are children born in 2021. To date, the IRS has not created a way for parents of newborns to update them about this child and their family and receive payments. So currently, they will have to wait until next tax season and later in the spring to receive money for those children.
Okay. And there are certainly parents who don't earn enough to pay taxes, or parents who are undocumented who could otherwise receive payments under this program because their children are citizens. How do you make sure they are getting help?
That is really critical. There are a lot of online efforts going on right now, different websites. I will say the approach we're taking is more of a grassroots approach. So in the pediatric clinic that I work in, we are having conversations with every family who comes in, simply asking them, are you aware of the new child tax credit? About 90% of them say no. So this type of grassroots work is very slow and tedious in some ways, but I found to be the most effective.
Republican critics of the expanded child care tax credit say they're worried about fraud or even disincentivizing parents from work. It's the same thing we heard about other benefits in the broader COVID relief program. Do you think that's an issue here?
I really don't. I know that it's a popular thing to say, but the evidence does not bear out that people don't want to work. Parents do want to work, but there are financial barriers to them working, things like childcare, transportation. This credit is actually empowering parents and letting them do so.
This is a temporary thing. These monthly payments will only be sent out for the next 6 months. How big of a dent can that make, given the need that's out there?
So it will be great for the next 6 months. As a pediatrician who cares about the future of our country and the development of children, I believe this should become a permanent policy to help raise healthy children.
Dr. Lucy Marshall, co-founder of Boston Medical Center's Street Cred Tax Help Program. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
If you could use a good chuckle right about now, you might want to check out the book Notes from the Bathroom Line, Humor, Art, and Low-Grade Panic from 150 of the Funniest Women in Comedy. And if you're not up to reading, there's also an audiobook. Here's a contribution from Cecily Strong.
I am one of the most morbid people I know. Now, I don't mean morbid like I'm super goth. I'm more of a Veda Saltenfuss from My Girl One. I easily forget appointments and plans and double book myself constantly. But you better believe I'll never forget the story of the German man who was killed by his own spiders and snakes and was found in his apartment covered in a spider web cocoon. Sorry, I just made you think about that. That's usually my quickest way to explain my nightmare brain.
Notes from the Bathroom Line was published in March. We spoke at that time with one of the contributors, Ayo Adeboye, the voice of Missy on the Netflix animated series Big Mouth. We also spoke with Amy Solomon, the book's editor. She's been a producer on the HBO series Barry and Silicon Valley. You know, Amy, I was thinking that now that we're like a year into this pandemic, that reading something funny and that made you laugh could actually be something that we really need right now. But then, I mean, I know this idea came about a long time ago for you. And in fact, you were trying to recreate a book you'd read when you were younger. Tell us about that.
Yeah, totally. So my ultimate icon queen is Gilda Radner. I grew up obsessed with her. I mean, I still have a bit of a shrine to her on my bookshelf. And so she contributed this book in 1976 called Titters. That was a big collection of humor by a ton of amazing women. And it was always insane to me that there was never another collection of humor by funny women since 1976. So it had always been my dream to do another. And that's no from the Bathroom Line.
Well, I knew you loved Gilda Radner, so we're going to hear a little bit from her, okay? This is Roseanne Rosanna Dana, the loudmouth consumer affairs reporter on Saturday Night Live's Weekend Update. Here she is reading a letter from a viewer.
Mr. Richard Fader from Fort Lee, New Jersey writes in and says, Dear Roseanne Rosanna Dana, last Thursday I quit smoking. Now, I'm depressed, I gained weight, my face broke out, I'm nauseous, I'm constipated, my feet swelled, my gums are bleeding, my sinuses are clogged, I got heartburn, I'm cranky, and I have gas. What should I do? Mr. Fader, you sound like a real attractive guy.
Oh, I just had to play that for you. Let's talk more about Gilda. What was it that inspired you with her?
Oh, I mean, how many people can get out there and like be yelling about being constipated and be that cute? Like, that's pretty rare. But also, you know, she was this like hilarious Jewish woman from the Midwest. That was a big deal for me. And there's just something so like sweet and vulnerable about her. And yeah, she's my big inspiration.
Yeah. So inspiration for the book as well. And it's, by the way, of course, entirely done by women, written by women. Why was that important for you?
Funny women have always been my favorite thing in the world. They've always been around when I went to college. They were all there when I moved to LA to work in comedy. They were all there. And clearly we should be making room for way more. And I hope this book shows people like, oh my God, you could hire all of these women to make your TV and movies and everything.
Are you like the most popular person? Do you really know all 150 of these comedians?
This really, really is not a good portrayal of me. I am a big dork with no friends. I knew a bunch of these women, and then I basically just spread this web of, I would ask them, like, who are your friends? Who are your favorite people? And that was part of what was so magical about doing the book, is they would be so excited to tell me about who their favorite gal pals were too. So I just slowly sort of spread this web of amazing women.
Well, one of them was Io. Io, are you still there?
Mm-hmm. I am. I'm still there. I was listening to the radio. I was like, what a lovely, informative interview.
Fascinating, wasn't it?
Intelligent people speaking about women in comedy. This is my type of show.
Let's bring you right in. Really,
I'm like reclined right now. I like pulled up a pillow and I'm just like, nice.
Oh, gosh. Throughout the book, look, I want to give you a chance to listen to some tape here, because throughout the book, Amy has comics like you responding to a prompt. And your answer to the prompt that asks for the story about the hardest you ever laughed involves this classic scene from The Office. Here's Rainn Wilson playing Dwight.
Last week, I gave a fire safety talk, and nobody paid any attention. It's my own fault for using PowerPoint. PowerPoint is boring. People learn in lots of different ways, but experience is the best teacher.
Okay, then Dwight starts a fire, and real panic ensues, mm-hmm. and then you're going to have to tell us what happens next to you.
What happened to me was, I grew up, for somebody who now is like a comedian and loves comedy, but I think I just grew up with like very specific references, and there were a lot of mainstream things that I just missed or just, I don't know, wasn't completely interested in, and I just somehow missed all of The Office. And when I was 21, I was working as a writer's assistant, and my coworker, who is in this book and I fear has seen this and now knows what happened, was just shocked that I had never seen this cold open, which is one of the most like iconic cold opens. And she started playing it for me, and the more that I watched, the more like I just could not stop laughing. It was the funniest thing that I had ever seen. And in the book, I say something like, the pressure that I felt in my head and my chest just like moved down and just would not really stop moving down. And by the time the cold open was done, I had relieved myself on myself. And not in a light way, not sort of like a dainty little, like it was fully, that was my bathroom break. Yes. And that was the hardest I ever laughed. And I still had to work for the rest of the day.
Well, then what happened? What happened after that?
Very late hours in that chair. Yeah. And what happened after that was I had to work in that chair. And I, you know, got a jacket, tied it around myself, clean up what I could. And you know, I actually haven't finished watching The Office, but I know it's really funny. I know it's really funny. And I know that for a fact for myself.
That's probably amazing. Good to avoid that. Wow. Okay. Thank you for that. Amy Solomon, I'm going to hand it over to you now, if you could.
Asking me.
I know. Amy Solomon, you were never given the opportunity to answer any of these prompts, so I'm going to ask you the same question. Do you have a story? Have you thought about this, the hardest you've ever laughed?
Yeah, and it's embarrassing for my sister, but she can handle it. But basically, you know, on Halloween, when you would go trick-or-treating and then you would come home and you'd sit on the floor and like trade candy with your friends, mm-hmm. and be like, oh, I like Crunch Bars, you like Milky Ways, like let's make a trade. And when we were little, I was probably like 10 and my sister was 7 or something. I was with her and my best friend Julia, and we were trading, and of course Io's story is about peeing herself and mine's about farts, but my sister, like as she stood up,
and they say women aren't funny.
Yeah. Farted into the like hardwood floor, and something about the hardwood floor just made it the most amazing fart of all time. And my friend Julia and I laughed so hard at my poor little sister. Let's be clear, there's a lot more than peeing and farts in this book. But that's what we've chosen for this very smart program.
Mm-hmm. I've never done an interview like this, that is for sure. But I'm glad. I'm really glad. Do you know why? Because it's been kind of a nasty, horrible year, and we kind of needed.
Sounds very unfamiliar. Not sure why.
No idea what you're referring to.
If that's even the thing to say to you too. Is it hard to be funny during a pandemic? Is that something you struggle with?
Yes. yes, very much so. I think there will be a very, I don't know, I'm excited for comedy to get to return in the capacity where it's like you're with people again. But it is hard. I think comedians and writers and artists were like really empathetic people. And so it's like you're trying to find joy in things and you're trying to find laughter, but you're so sensitive to all this grief and all this mourning and confusion and sadness. And so it has been really hard for me, but it also has been kind of inspiring to see people who I look up to and people who are my friends trying to make joy out of this moment. But, so a lot of days it's hard to find something funny when I've been watching the same season of Midsummer Murders, you know, for a year now.
Well, Amy, we do kind of need it, don't we? I mean, I remember a couple of weeks ago, I'd just gotten back from a COVID funeral, and I was in the car the next day driving my kids to school, and I was listening to commercial radio, and there was like this absolutely perfect, amazing, hilarious prank call on the radio, and I was laughing so hard, I was crying. I thought I was going to crash the car. And afterwards, I was just thinking to myself, like, God, we really need this. Don't we?
Yeah. Did you pee yourself IO style?
No, I've never done that. That's just ridiculous.
And we're calling it IO style now, just to confirm. Just sort of
that. I've been so grateful to the people that have made us laugh through all of this. I mean, like watching IO on Big Mouth was so amazing. Like the stuff that's come out this year has been like such a saving grace. People who have found a way to be funny, like, have been so helpful.
The new book is Notes from the Bathroom Line, Humor, Art, and Low-Grade Panic from 150 of the Funniest Women in Comedy. We've got two of them here, the editor Amy Solomon and one of the contributors, Ayo Adebari. Thanks to you both. Seriously, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Our interview from last March.
Good question.
That's a really good question.
It's a great question.
This is free therapy.
Thank you for asking me that.
God, that's such a good question.
That's an interesting question.
But what Fresh Air interviews are really about are the interesting answers. Listen and subscribe to Fresh Air from WHYY and NPR.
Most full-time workers across the U.S. who earn minimum wage cannot afford a place to live. That's according to a new report from the National Low Income Housing Coalition. It found that minimum wage workers in 93% of counties across the country can't even afford a one-bedroom apartment. Let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, good. So this is really quite remarkable. First, explain what the report considers an affordable housing expense.
Affordability here is defined as the hourly wage a full-time worker must earn to spend no more than 30% of their income on rent, 30% being consistent with, you know, personal finance 101, budgeting 101. This year, workers would need to earn just under $25 an hour for a two-bedroom home, and $20.40 per hour for a one-bedroom rental. That's up from about $24 and $19.56 last year.
Okay, minimum wage way below that, in everywhere, and for some worse than others. The rates vary across the country for minimum wage, as do rent prices. But on average, how much more would a minimum wage worker need to earn to be able to afford a one-bedroom apartment?
Yeah, the average hourly worker currently earns just under $19 per hour. So you're a good $6 shy for just a one-bedroom rental. This is all in theory, of course. As you mentioned, with state and local wage requirements all over the place, the report finds that the average minimum wage worker in the U.S. would need to work nearly 97 hours per week just to afford the average two-bedroom home. We're talking 100 hours a week here, well more than two full-time jobs. I mean, a junior banker on Wall Street who works 90 100-hour weeks is making, you know, mid-six figures, $140,000, $150,000, and after a bonus with all sorts of benefits. So it is really striking.
The report also breaks down the racial disparities that are a significant part of the problem. What do the numbers tell us about that?
Black and Latino workers who we know already make less than their white counterparts, they're more likely to spend more of their take-home on rent. In this case, more than 40% of Black and Latino households spend north of 30% on their income on rent versus 25% of white households. So 40% households of color versus 25% of white households.
In our final minute here, I want to ask, what's the most effective solution to this problem? Is it simply raising the minimum wage? Certainly easier said than done. Is it lowering rent prices? Also hardly an easy thing to do. Maybe both. What is the answer?
I don't believe there's a fast and easy quick fix of just a couple of bucks over a few years. You know, what you're seeing is such a yawning chasm between prevailing wages, which have been stagnant, and the cost of living, which has been increasing, to say nothing of other inflationary pressures that we've been talking about recently. And what about the federal, state, and food, you know, federal and state food, housing, healthcare assistance that goes to so many low-wage workers in the service sector, while the likes of Walmart and McDonald's pay out big executive compensation and shareholder dividends and buybacks? If minimum wage workers in 93% of counties across the nation can't even afford a one-bedroom apartment, we should be asking how useful this minimum wage reading is to begin with.
Robin Farzad is host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Thanks, Robin.
Thank you, Don.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel visits President Biden at the White House this afternoon. It's likely to be her last official visit because she's stepping down this fall. The U.S. and Germany are allies, of course, but there's also some tension between the two countries over a Russian gas pipeline that Washington opposes. Dan Hamilton is director of the Global Europe Program at the Wilson Center. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Thank you, Don. Thank you.
The overarching theme for this meeting at the White House is the friendship between the U.S. and Germany. How would you describe the relationship in this first year of the Biden administration?
Well, Chancellor Merkel, you know, in the last number of turbulent years, started to gain the mantle of leader of the free world. It's not a mantle she wore very comfortably, and I think she's happy to give it back to the President of the United States. I think this meeting is sort of some of that transfer. The relationship's gone well, but she has been a bit hesitant to fully embrace the Biden administration's agenda because she's conscious of the delicate political balance going on in the United States, and the Republicans could take, again, a house or two in the U.S. Congress in the midterms.
So one of the things they'll be talking about, President Biden halted the Trump administration's plan to pull thousands of American troops out of Germany. Why is it important, in your view, that we keep those troops there?
Germany was not only the front line of the Cold War, but it's become, since the end of the Cold War, sort of a secure platform for U.S. forces, not only for Europe, but for the Middle East, Afghanistan, Africa, many other places. The medical facilities in Germany, or where injured U.S. Servicemen from Afghanistan, Africa, Middle East go, because the flights to the United States are so far away. Germany is the staging area for U.S. forward presence and NATO forward presence on the eastern flanks of NATO. So it has been the center of Africa Command for the U.S. military. So even though the threat today may seem a bit more remote than it was during the Cold War, Germany is still a principal ally. It also has forces in Afghanistan. It's been training forces in Iraq. It's a critically important partner in the Western Balkans, as well as these broader projection capabilities. It's the base for U.S. power projection in much of the rest of the world.
Okay, the one sticking point, if that's not too strong of a word in these talks today, is that Russian gas pipeline. It's a pipeline to Germany. Is there room to compromise, and why does Washington oppose it?
The opposition is that the pipeline not only bypasses a number of East European countries because it goes through the Baltic Sea, it basically cuts out Ukraine as a gas transit country. And gas revenues for Ukraine, a country that's been assaulted by Russia, is in fragile shape, are crucial, those gas revenues. And so President Biden called it a bad deal, and there's vociferous opposition in the U.S. Congress. Chancellor Merkel has continued to back the deal. So might be a compromise.
No, it's okay. Just quickly, you alluded to Chancellor Merkel as being the leader of the free world, de facto anyway, during the Trump years. Can you just talk about her legacy in this last 20 seconds we've got?
She's had a profound impact. You know, she's been chancellor for four U.S. presidents, seen them come and go. There have been ups and downs in the relationship, but she has never wavered from her commitment to Atlanticist Germany that looks outward together with the United States. As the daughter of an East German, East Germany, it's quite a life story she has. And I think
I'm going to have to cut you there. Dan Hamilton is the director of the Global Europe Program at the Wilson Center. Thank you.
Thank you.
To South America now, where the planet is losing an important buffer against global warming. A study published yesterday in the journal Nature found part of the Amazon rainforest is now putting out more carbon dioxide than it absorbs. Blame deforestation, intentional fires, heat waves. Scott Denning is a professor at Colorado State University's Department of Atmospheric Science, and he wrote the article that accompanied the scientific study. Scott, it is good to speak with you.
And good to be here. Thank you.
But the topic is difficult because we often hear the Amazon described as the lungs of the planet. And now to hear that they are releasing, the forest is releasing more carbon than it is absorbing. How alarming is that to scientists?
Well, it's certainly not good news. On the other hand, this is something that a lot of us have been concerned about for a long time. There's been a series of studies over the last 10 or 15 years that show the uptake of carbon by the forest decreasing. The difference here is that rather than going out and measuring trees on the ground, which, you know, you can never be sure the ones you measure are representative of an entire continent, this study actually measured the CO2 in the air with small airplanes across the Amazon for 9 years. And so it's a very comprehensive survey of the region. And it is certainly concerning that the uptake of carbon by the forest is decreasing and even has reversed in large areas.
Remind us how important the Amazon is to the entire planet.
So the Amazon is very important for the planet in many ways. It's certainly not just for sucking up fossil fuel CO2 from the atmosphere. It's the most productive ecosystem on Earth. It's one of the most biodiverse. But from the point of view of the carbon cycle, the Amazon is converting huge amounts of CO2 from the atmosphere into wood that eventually gets, you know, eaten by bacteria and so forth after the trees die. So there's this very rapid cycling of carbon in and out of the forest. The trouble now, of course, is that the forest is dying faster than it's growing, especially along its boundaries.
Well, can we talk about that? Because that gets to the question of why this is happening, why the forest is no longer the carbon sink that it has been for so long. Is it because of the fires that we've been hearing so much about burning in the Amazon?
There's a whole confluence of things that are happening, particularly along the eastern edge of the Amazon. It's important for listeners to understand this is a huge area we're talking about. It's almost as big as the continental United States. So it's a gigantic area. And along the south and east fringe of the Amazon, there's a lot of deforestation, a lot of development. There's also, of course, logging for wood and wood products. And all of that is happening in the context of global climate change. So it's also warming up at the same time that it's being cut back. The trees get stressed by drought. That makes them more susceptible to burn. And then that sets a sort of feedback effect into motion where more dead trees leads to more water loss and more drought and more heat and so forth. So it's a It's almost like a chain reaction along the eastern fringe of the Amazon.
And what are the consequences potentially for that chain reaction on the planet?
The immediate consequence that's the subject of this major new study is that where the forest used to take up net carbon from the atmosphere, so essentially is providing freebie emissions reductions, right? We would like to cut our fossil fuel emissions, and the Amazon and other forests have been doing that for us for free by growing trees faster than the trees were dying. And now that's reversed. And so the large areas on the eastern side of the Amazon are now adding to the CO2 in the air instead of subtracting from the CO2 in the air. So there's both sort of regional consequences for the plants, animals, and people that live there, and also kind of global consequences for our atmosphere, for our climate system, for our economic and social systems.
Hmm. So what do we do about it?
The main thing that we have to do, and I'm sorry if this sounds a little flip, is we got to stop setting carbon on fire, right? We got to stop digging coal, oil, and gas out of the ground and using it to fuel our energy and economic systems as quickly as we can, because the Earth system is no longer providing this free service of sucking that carbon down as much as it used to. We need to learn to live better lives without setting carbon on fire.
Scott Denning is professor at Colorado State University's Department of Atmospheric Science on the article in the journal Nature that says the Amazon forest, once known as the lungs of the planet, now emitting more carbon than it is absorbing. Scott, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
The state of Idaho has a new law on wolves. It expands hunting and trapping opportunities and makes more money available to kill the animals. But a group of ranchers is taking a different approach to avoid predator-livestock conflicts before they happen. Rachel Cohen from Boise State Public Radio reports.
Logan Miller is scanning the forest floor. He's looking for signs.
You see how this has been broken? How the bone has been snapped?
Miller works for the Wood River Wolf Project. We're not too far from the city of Haley on a popular trail. It might not have been a wolf that made this kill we're examining, he says, but maybe one came by and checked out the leftovers.
Wolves' jaws are powerful enough to break bone.
He scribbles in his notebook, takes down the GPS location, and does this whenever he sees a clue. A track, some scat, signs of prey. He's trying to piece together where the wolves are hanging out. Environmentalists, a wildlife services agent, and a rancher started the Wolf Project in 2008. The goal is to employ non-lethal methods to prevent wolves from killing livestock. Sun Valley is one of the most historic sheep ranching spots in the country. Each year, ranchers bring their herds up to the mountains to graze, and Miller helps keep them safe from wolves. A pack was spotted in this part of the valley recently, and Miller's returned to set up a wildlife camera and do a howling survey. He climbs off trail, sits still for over an hour, and calls out to the wolves. Then he waits for a call back. Nothing today. But when he does hear something,
that's a good indication. Okay, something's going on right here.
He's gathering intel so he can direct sheep away from those trouble spots. Sometimes that's not possible, and the herders he works with deploy air horns and flashing lights.
Just making sound and flashing lights to scare wolves away.
Since the project started more than a decade ago, the number of sheep killed in the area is down. Only one wolf has been killed. Yet the effort is an outlier in Idaho, because ranchers here prefer to use lethal methods and want to lower the wolf population. Now, because of new legislation passed this year, that's easier. There are more opportunities for hunting and trapping, and private contractors can kill wolves on behalf of the state. Miller thinks the new rules could have implications for the Wolf Project's work. He says more wolf hunting will inevitably break up packs, and without a cohesive unit, they might not be able to go after traditional prey, instead opting for easier targets, livestock. That theory has been supported, but also challenged by research. Still, the non-lethal work will continue this summer. One rancher who works with the Wood River Wolf Project is Corey Peavy, the sheep manager at Flat Top Ranch in Cary. Initially, he was skeptical.
I wasn't convinced that a few flashing lights and proverbially banging pots and pans was going to make any kind of difference.
Using non-lethal methods takes time and coordination, Peavy says, but it's been working.
If you implement things that change, if you move a pickup, if you move lights around, something for them to fixate their curiosity on, it's enough to inspire caution. in the wolves.
And he's trying other things on his own, like a pilot study with a researcher who's monitoring if attaching flashing lights to his sheep's ears will deter predators. Making these changes is risky, he says. For example, the lights could stress the sheep out, and that could affect their growth. But he's willing to experiment for a larger good.
I see the potential benefit as being worth it, so I take that risk.
The Wolf Project reduces some of that risk because it pays for Logan Miller's position and all the gear it gives to the sheep herders. And non-lethal management recently got a big boost. In each of the past 2 years, Wildlife Services, a government agency which often responds to ranchers' calls by killing wolves, has received a $1.4 million appropriation from the federal budget for non-lethal projects in 12 states. In Idaho, the funding means 3 new range riders. They ride horses alongside cattle to protect them from predators. 2 riders started last year, says State Wildlife Services Director Jared Hedelius.
I reached back out to those livestock producers and said, hey, I've got this funding available. Are you interested? And they all were instantly, yes, absolutely. We want them to come back.
He says he hopes the funding continues, but not everyone is fully on board. Steve Smith ranches near the town Mackey, where one of the range riders was recently hired. He says the valley is vast, and that person can't be everywhere at once. And he thinks the new wolf legislation will help prevent wolves from killing livestock.
Year-round, taking some wolves down, that's going to make a difference. That's going to make a difference.
He thinks the new non-lethal positions are only meant to appease environmentalists who are against the direction Idaho is taking on managing wolves. And even the ranchers who are using preventative measures, like Corey Peavy, don't want to lose lethal methods.
I am not interested in removing any tools from the toolkit, but I will try and deploy them responsibly and try and avoid an issue like that. But come to it, yeah, I will defend my livelihood. I will.
But he knows coexistence of ranching and wolves is important to his community in the valley where his sheep pass through. So he says he'll continue to try all the non-lethal methods he can, as long as they're working. For Here and Now, I'm Rachel Cohen.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Don Gagne. It's Here and Now. Mm-hmm.